I'm the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, heard live every morning on LATalkRadio.com, available for download and listen while you want through free apps. We also are in iTunes, and you can access the program at themariasanchezshow.com and mariasanchezshow.com. So thank you for joining us. It's Wednesday, May 15th, and before we get into our program, which we're packed as usual. It's a tight 50 minutes, so I'm accustomed to doing 3 hours, so this has been quite the adjustment for me. And ironically, in the terrestrial radio days of my career, I would probably prep hour for hour. So with a three-hour broadcast, there would be 3 hours of prep going into, you know, who, what, latest news, etc. I'm finding that I'm prepping more for this program because since it's 50 minutes, they have to be delicious and essential minutes. And so I'm doing 3.5, 4.5 hours of prep, so distill it on down. If you're new to the program, we start with the 5 top stories that you need to know so that you know what's going on the planet. But today we're going to diverge just a little bit because I mentioned yesterday that right before we were live on the program, a girlfriend texted me to say that she had heard that former NFL superstar Chuck Muncy had passed away. And I quick Googled and I saw that that was the case. And so I had about 90 seconds to process that information before the mic was hot. And to say that it took me by surprise is an understatement. He turned 60 in March of this year. And we met professionally in 2008 with a common broadcasting career. We were going to partner up on a couple of things, and we ended up becoming romantically involved. And subsequently, he proposed to me, and we got engaged. We didn't end up getting married, but we ended up staying very close and in close contact, and we dated subsequently. But we just couldn't make it work. But I have the utmost respect for the man. I knew him post his career. I didn't know Chuck Muncy, the NFL superstar, the California UC Berkeley superstar, second in the Heisman Trophy voting in 1975 behind Archie Griffin, who won all the records that he established for the New Orleans Saints and the San Diego Chargers, some of which stand to this day. One of the funniest things that I learned about him is that he actually completed 4 passes in his career, all for touchdowns. So he was quite the athlete, and he was addled with some of his addictions, which ended up, he was sentenced to 18 months in prison for selling cocaine. But the man that I knew, the man that I loved, the man that I fell in love with, was the Chuck Muncy that maybe a lot of people wouldn't have known, because he was a big guy, 6'3". When he played, he was playing at around 250. When I met him, he was heavier, I don't know, 275 or something like that. You guys always know about that weight thing. I don't. But he was just a gentle giant. And I have 4 children, and my youngest daughter, Catherine, was in high school at the time when we were dating. And when she met him, she hugged him. And she knew that we were dating at the time. And she said, "He's a teddy bear." And so from that day forward, she never called him Mr. Muncy, because I always have my children, when I was raising them, that they would call my friends Mr. or Mrs. or Doctor or what have you. Old school, I know. So she called him Mr. TB from that day forward, because he was Mr. Teddy Bear. So and then I had the honor of meeting his daughter, Danielle, and at that time she had 2 children. She's since then had a third, and she made a statement yesterday about his passing. She says, "I knew him as a loving father and a man." Pardon me. who doted on his three grandchildren. Our entire family will miss him greatly. His work with at-risk youth, the Boys and Girls Clubs, and his foundation is what really made him shine. And the foundation she's talking about is the Chuck Muncy Youth Foundation, which he established in 1997. It was set up to counsel young folks and offer alternatives to gangs. One of the proudest things that he liked about the foundation was it paid for a tattoo removal program for gang members. And Chuck also mentored athletes at Cal, the University of California at Berkeley, which was his alma mater. And he had a combine, which was for to help high school youth get seen and recruited and stuff. So the accolades keep pouring in, and it's nice to know that somebody can take something that happened adversely to them, i.e. his drug issues, and basically ended his career, because when he tested positive for cocaine, Commissioner Pete Rozelle suspended him for the rest of the season. That was after the first season game. I don't condone drug use, and certainly not steroids and juicing and all that sort of thing. But I often wonder, too, if you show up to the job and you do the job, should it really matter what you do in your private life? I mean, if you're breaking laws, I get that. So I guess since cocaine use is illegal, that would not make my argument very sound. But, and if you're abusing somebody or, you know, raping children or whatever, obviously that's not okay. And somebody, you know, I don't care what field you're in, entertainment or sports or, you know, white collar, blue collar, construction, farm worker, et cetera. Obviously we have to uphold our laws. But he was doing the do, and unfortunately, it was too much that he couldn't abstain or subside. But again, the man that I knew, it was funny, the night, in retrospect, that he proposed to me, he hadn't been married but the one time to his ex-wife, Robin, who's the mother of Danielle, their daughter, and he had never married subsequent to that divorce. And so he was telling me that he wanted to spend a life with me. In fact, there's a broadcast out there. Chuck and I did a New Year's Eve television broadcast from the Watermark Hotel in the city of Ventura here in Southern California. And he basically kind of proposed to me on the air there, saying something about making a trip to Vegas or something. And our producer at the time, Bob Allen, who was my business partner then too, said, which is how I met the two of them, said, I think that, and I was like, I'm not going to go there. So we were at my home after we had gone out for dinner, and the sweet guy, here he is, 6'3", you know, running back, huge hands, big guy, and he starts crying. And so that's kind of remarkable, you know, this big guy. And he gets down on one knee and he starts blubbering that he wants to marry me. And will I marry him? And he's never proposed to anybody since his first wife. And I was like, that is so sweet. So, of course, I started crying because, as you can tell, I'm a fairly emotional person. And so we were engaged. So. May you rest in peace, Mr. Chuck Muncy. And Danielle, I hope you're going to be okay. And if the funeral is doable, I don't know the details yet. I definitely will be in attendance. So we're going to cut just to three stories because of the time that I just took now. But the FBI opens a criminal probe of the IRS, and that announcement came yesterday by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. And ironically, it came about 4 hours before an inspector general's report on the IRS, which portrayed the tax agency as plagued by disarray and insufficient oversight. So the report was by the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, and it criticized the way the IRS had screened the conservative groups, citing poor management and processing delays. So they're getting into that. And we mentioned a little bit when the story first broke, that it wasn't just these conservative groups, Tea Party, Patriot, et cetera, that there was Jewish groups that were scrutinized as well based on their ties to Israel. So later on in our program this morning, we have a visitor from the Jewish American Heritage Month, which is May also, and we're going to speak to that as well. And then the Attorney General also made the announcement that he did not make the decision to secretly seize the telephone records of the AP reporters. So that's going interesting about that, because he's, Eric Holder said that the leak that prompted the AP subpoena was very serious, and he says was among the most serious breaches he has ever seen. But he recused himself from that decision because he said that he had been interviewed by the FBI as part of the same leak investigation that targeted the AP records, and so he said it could be a potential conflict of interest. So that story is unfolding, and the reason they were looking at the AP is because of a story that was published on May 7th, and it was talking about an operation conducted by the CIA and allied intelligence agencies that stopped a Yemen-based al-Qaeda plot to detonate a bomb on an airplane headed for the United States. So that's what brought it all together. And then finally, the top story of today, this morning, is that yesterday, and they did it on purpose, but the National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, as you might have heard it, has recommended that all 50 states adopt a blood alcohol content, or BAC, that's what that stands for, cutoff of 0.05 compared to the 0.08 standard that's on the books today. The chairman of the NTSB says it's still a national epidemic. About a third of all road deaths in the United States are attributed to drunk driving. They claim that lowering the rate to 0.05 would save about 500 to 800 lives annually. And there is a calculator, a online blood alcohol calculator that I would suggest that you reference, and it's published by the University of Oklahoma. And it says that under the law of 0.08, a 180-pound male typically will hit the 0.08 threshold after four drinks over an hour. So I always thought the rule of thumb was one drink an hour and you will stay under the limit. So that seems to expand it quite a bit. So that's also in the news today. They're saying that more than 100 countries on six continents have BAC limits set at 0.05 or lower, and that the number of alcohol-related highway fatalities, when we had, if you can believe, in the early 80s, many states had a 0.15 BAC rate to say that you were driving under the influence. So about 24 years ago, Mothers Against Drunk Driving and a couple other groups got together and lobbied to have the level pushed down to 0.08, which all 50 states have done, the last state doing so in 2004. The alcohol-related highway fatalities dropped from 20,000 in 1980 to under 10,000 in 2011. So a 50% decline, which is, you know, you can't argue with those statistics. So that's, the NTSB can only make recommendations. It can't mandate anything, but they're saying that everybody takes it seriously, what they have to say. Also, the reason they announced it yesterday, I said, was deliberately on the anniversary. Yesterday was May 14th. In 1988, a drunk driver drove his pickup the wrong way in Kentucky. The truck hit a school bus. It killed 24 children and three adults. More than 30 others were hurt, and that is considered the deadliest alcohol-related crash in U.S. history. And now we're going to connect with our first guest. His name is Bill Riddell. He is a has been a high school football coach. He's been a college football player. He has played in the Canadian Football League, and he is going to be our guest this morning. He's going to talk with us about high school football and how it's changed over his career. Raw Live Radio.
Hello.
Hi, Bill. Bill Riddell, you're on the Maria Sanchez Show. Good morning. Thank you for agreeing
All
to
right.
speak
morning
with us.
All right, morning to you.
Bill, would you give our listeners a little bit about your background, please, because you have had quite the career, both college and professionally, as a player yourself, and then we'll get into your coaching days and what you see the world of high school football is all about.
Yeah, okay. Well, I played at Occidental College and then got drafted by the Rams and the Denver Broncos. In those years, there was the two, the NFL and the AFL were separate. Went with the Rams for a cup of coffee, then played 7 years up in the Canadian Football League, retired in 1969, and then coached Cal State Fullerton in 1970 as an assistant coach for Dick Corey, and did that for a year. And then all the coaches were killed in a plane crash except for myself and the and Dick. And so I got out of coaching for like 8 or 9 years, and came back and coached. We moved, you know, I was in the insurance business, then came back and we moved to Westlake Village and got started with my kids in the Pop Warner ranks for 80, 81, and then went to actually 78, 79, and then went to Cal Lutheran as an assistant coach for a couple years for Bob Schaup, then took the Crespi job in 1982, and then went to the USFL. Dick Corey was the head coach at Cal State Fullerton, went to the NFL after he got out of, after he left college. And so I was with him in the USFL for 2 years with the Boston Breakers, then the New Orleans Breakers, and then they moved to Portland, and I left before they went to Portland, went back to Crespi for 4 years, then got out of coaching and for like 4 years, watched my son. Cheryl and I watched our son Ronnie go through Stanford. He played, he was a corner for Stanford. And then came back to St. Francis High School for 7, then Oaks Christian School, who's right right in my backyard, opened up in 2000, and I was fortunate enough to get that job, and you know, held that through 2011 season, and then retired from coaching.
Now,
so that gives you, go ahead.
You have, as I said, an illustrious career, far ranging, and seen all kinds of aspects of the game of football. And to drill down to locally, the Oaks tenure that you had, I think you should explain to the listeners that people, if they're familiar with high school football, probably have heard of Oaks Christian. And while it is a powerhouse and directly related to your stewardship, you started with not knowing who and what you were going to get, because the school only had freshman and sophomore, and of that there would be 50% that would be male, and of that how many would play football, and you know, could you even field the team? And you certainly couldn't play varsity because you didn't even have juniors on the
squad.
Well,
yeah, that's right. We played a junior varsity schedule. And actually, we did actually play, I think, 2 varsity games, and we ended up going 7-3 that first year in 2000. But it was a little you know, nervous time when we opened up at a park over in Oak Park, park over there, Oak Grove Park, I think it was, and I think we had like 20 kids, you know, show up, but we ended up having like 47, something like that, on the team. And, you know, they were great. They were outstanding. They were the nucleus in the beginning of that run that we had, where we won CIF, we won 7 CIF championships, and we won 6 in a row. And just some great kids. It's like that movie, Field of Dreams. You know, mm-hmm. You build it, and they will come, and that's what happened. Now, you know, people think we went out and recruited all these kids and so forth. That wasn't the case. They just, you know, they were looking for a good, solid private school Christian education, and many people, and certainly the culture of the school and the Christian culture of the school, I think, drew a lot of kids. And we were fortunate to ever draw some outstanding coaches like Clay Matthews and Mark Bates and Mike Sherrard and some of these great you know, NFL players, Mike Mayo and Bob Richards, who was the head coach at Thousand Oaks High School for so many years. We were able to draw some great coaches that end up coaching on that team. So we had great kids. I think we put 47 to 50 kids that have gone Division I football. My tenure there.
That's an amazing number. I was going to ask you about that, because you have since, obviously, now you had a reputation that was attracting before, when it was just a field of dust, if you will. It was we want to play with the big boys. Because can you talk about the league too, and you know how you've moved up that rank, or Oaks did?
Well, we started off as an independent school, as far as the league, as far as football is concerned. We was playing an independent schedule, which I think was good. Did that for a couple of years, and then we went into the Tri-Valley League, and which is with you know, Nordoff, Oak Park, schools like that. And they weren't real anxious for us to come in, but they were real anxious for us to get out. And so then we moved into the Miramani League with Westlake, you know, and Thousand Oaks, and we ended up winning the CF championship that first year in. And then the next year in that league, we went to the CIF championship game and lost to lost to Westlake, 49-42, I think it was. And so that, nobody has been real excited about Oaks Christian or St. Bonaventure joining other joining their leagues. There's just a lot of miscommunications between really good people on both sides of the issue, between private school and public school. The public schools feel the private schools have this big advantage where they get people from all over. But, of course, the tuition at Oaks Christian, you know, to somewhere around $28,000, and you can go to Westlake, which is a very fine football program, very fine school academically and athletic. You can go there for nothing. So, but there's just a lot of miscommunications, and the two sides don't seem to be able to get together. It's kind of like the Republicans and the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good people, but they don't seem to be able to work the thing out. So this new league that they've started or gonna start in 2014. Where St. Bonaventure and Oaks Christian will be coming out of the Miramonte League and going into this, you know, different league, and I think it's a little worse for, because it's in all sports, not just football. Football is the easiest one. You only play a 10-game schedule, and half the games are at home, and the games are Friday night. But now with the leagues, with this new thing that's coming on, you know, forcing St. Bonaventure and Oaks Christian, I mean, they have to travel. I mean, you know, St. Bonnie, take St. Bonnie, you know, 35, 40, 45 minutes just to get down to Oaks Christian. You got another 45 minutes to go, so there's going to be a lot of school time, you know, missed. So I was not involved in that, but I really don't see the reasoning, you know, for it. I think there's better conclusions they can come up with, like maybe they come up with a private school league just for football, because the football generated the whole thing. The whole problem has been football. They want to get football out of those other leagues, St. Bonnie and Oaks Christian.
So, and as I understand, public schools have a last period for athletes to allow them to travel to games, if you will, and I don't believe that private schools offer that.
They do not. There's not a physical education period. I don't know what they call it in the public school, but they do have a period where they, you know, it's a weightlifting period, and so they, you know, they miss that. But with the travel schedule now, they're going to have to leave at noon in some of the cases to be able to play. Not so much football,
mm-hmm.
but in the other sports, you're going to have to leave at noon. Yeah, but they do. That's where maybe a public school has a little bit of advantage, because they usually have this, you know, physical education period, you know, for an hour where they film, study, and do things like that. I know Westlake High School has. I know Jim spends, you know, other than on the practice field, he's probably got 2-3 hours, a couple hours a day that he's able to spend, you know, with film watching with his team and you know, weightlifting. Whereas the private school, Oaks Christian in particular, they did not have that. But I really don't look at it as an advantage. I quite frankly think athletics at the high school level is way, way, way out of proportion with the time, with all these club sports, and, you know, a kid that wants to play, you know, football, they'll play 60, 70 passing league games during the summer. It's almost two leagues now. A coach can lose his job over the fact he didn't do well in the passing league during the summertime. There's just way too much time. Kids don't have a chance to be kids. One out of every 10,000 players, high school players, make it to the NFL. In the NFL, their average lifespan of playing in the NFL is, you know, 3 years. But one out of every 10,000 make it. I think there's far too much time spent on sports. Well, it's a great thing, a positive is, you know, maybe keeps kids out of trouble, you know, so forth. But there's just no time for a kid to be a kid anymore.
So what's the deal with all these passing leagues? And I mean, it's to ostensibly hone their craft and their techniques and their skills and make them better players, I would imagine.
Oh yeah, make them better players, make the team better, especially in the passing game, and I think all that stuff. Well, now there's a lot of what I was playing, you know, many years ago. But now kids have private coaches for playing quarterback, private coaches for being a receiver. Even in the, you know, in the soccer and all those other sports, there's a lot of club sports now. I think club sports are beginning to take over in some cases. Let's take soccer. There's a lot of club soccer. I think they're very good. I think they've got some very fine coaches, you know, club soccer. But oftentimes a kid will get into the CIF playoffs and he'll be playing high school soccer and then playing club soccer. And so they'll make the CIF playoffs, they'll be going into a CIF championship game, and they'll have a club soccer game, and two of the players that are stars for the team will end up playing in a club soccer game rather than for his local high school team. To me, it's way out of balance.
So to go back to a point that you made about private versus public, there is suspicion that some of the private schools are offering athletic scholarships so that they're paying or buying their players.
Well, there's rumors about that. There's all kind of rumors that Oaks Christian did that. That was not the case, and so I've heard that. I don't think they do that, but it's rumored to do that. Okay, I remember Oaks Christian. Everybody thought that Oaks Christian gave scholarships. Oaks Christian's, everything's based on financial need, and the fact is you can run a 4.440, you know, doesn't mean that they found financial aid for you. Whatever your W-2s and your federal tax return, you know, showed that you're worth, and they figured it out, and there's a formula, and it was done by a third party. That's what you qualified for. That's what you got. And you had to get in academically, too. So I don't think that is the case. You know, if I do, I'm not positive of the rule with other schools. I know at Oaks Christian did not do that. And I don't believe that other schools do offer, those private schools do offer athletic scholarships. But I could be wrong on that. Maybe some do.
And I guess that would be in their policy, but at least you're refuting the rumors that have been swirling around Oaks.
That's unbelievable, the rumors that flew around, you know, Oaks. You know, how could Montana and Gretzky's and all these people come to, of course, they can afford to come.
Right.
But, you know, Will Smith and all these. But, hey, listen, it was a great program. But there's a lot of great programs around. Westlake High School is a great program, okay? And Jim Benker's done a fabulous job there. So there's a lot of opportunities to choose from.
Nick, can you speak about the safety and the players now versus what it might have been 10, 20 years ago? Because
I can go back further than that compared to when I played. I mean, you were taught to do almost everything with your head. I mean, if you... You know, you're taught that, you know, the body follows the head. So if you take the head out, then the body will follow. So, I mean, that's the way you're kind of taught. You're taught to lead with your helmet, not with the crown of your helmet, but with the forehead part of your helmet. You're taught to, you know, tackle that way and do a lot of things that way. So, and nobody thought anything about it. That was just, you know, just the way that you played. And then when you got, they call it when you got your bell rung on the sideline, then that wasn't anything. I was just, you know, you just right back in the game, or if you did get knocked out for a little bit, you know, they put you back in as soon as you came, you know, as soon as you came around again. Now, I mean, if you really had a serious concussion, they didn't play you.
Right.
Everything was taught to go after the head way back those, you know, in the 50s and the 60s. And I'm sure obviously the game's improved. And when at Oaks Christian, we didn't teach that, but it's improved a lot, and there was a long way to go. Helmets have improved tremendously. And I think the coaching techniques has improved tremendously. The research has improved things, but they still have a long way to go. I think you'll see some significant rule changes, in the NFL, which will filter down through the colleges and the high school, that will, you know, make it a more safety game, because the players are bigger, faster, and stronger now. Equipment's
mm-hmm.
better, but
mm-hmm.
the players are bigger, faster, stronger, so there's a lot more at risk, especially with head injuries.
Well, and have you seen in your career, do you have a rule of thumb of how you coach in that regard? If you've seen somebody get their bell rung, for example, do we have, like, are they automatically put to the sidelines for X amount of time?
Well, they are now. I mean, in fact, the referees even require it. If the referee feels like a kid is, a little bit dizzy or something, he can take him out of the game and put him on the sideline. And now you have a doctor on the sideline, you know, all the time,
mm-hmm.
and the doctor makes those decisions. And the trainer, most of the trainers are, trained in regards to being able to recognize this. And if the trainer or the doctor or the referee can even overrule the doctor. But so in the last few years, kid that, you know, got a head injury and complained about it, he wasn't going back in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, they didn't.
So in terms of, because you have sons and now you have grandsons, and I understand one of your grandsons is going to be playing for Oaks in the fall.
Yeah.
So, talk Daniel. About a legacy. If someone's listening and they're thinking about a career with their kids, what's your advice? How early should you start? Do you still advocate Pop Warner?
Well, to be honest with you, now I think I'd play golf or tennis. Golf or tennis, something you can play for a long time.
Uh-huh.
I know a lot of pro football players in the past would not let their kids play tackle football until they got to high school.
That was my rule with my sons.
Yeah.
I let them play
and
flag.
I think there's some credibility to that. I don't think kids are ready to take the contact that you receive in the Pop Warner level. So I think there maybe needs to be some changes made down there. Now, saying that, I had my kids, as soon as they were able to go, okay, in the fifth grade, fourth grade, whatever mm-hmm. it was, they mm-hmm. played Pop Warner football, and they came through it fine. And I coached the Pop Warner football. A lot of great things that can come out of that Pop Warner football. But I think they ought to switch it to just playing flag football. I don't think kids physically are ready to play. Mm-hmm. And my grandsons played, and I did not particularly like it. I'm not real excited about my grandsons playing high school football. Hmm. I just I feel like maybe their sport would be lacrosse or baseball or track or something like that. But they said they love the game, and so they want to play. But it's a tough game, but I think they can do a lot of things to make it safer, which they're beginning to do.
Good. Well, Bill, thank you so much for taking the time and for being our sports correspondent. So as the news dictates, you will be able to comment on it from your unique point of view.
All right. Hey, I appreciate it. Nice talking with you.
Great to talk with you, too. Coach Bill Riddell, and he's had just an amazing history, which is wonderful in regards to what he's done and what his perspective. He just turned 72. He had his knee replaced, and he's like 3 weeks out.
Hello.
Hi, good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, Abby Schwartz. Abby is the National Coordinator for Jewish American Heritage Month. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for sharing what Jewish American Heritage Month means for the month of May for our listeners.
Thank you, Maria. I'm delighted to be here.
Can you tell us what the genesis was for having a month to honor Jewish
Absolutely, absolutely. There were several communities, most notably South Florida, that really believed that this should be something that happens every year, like many other months that are designated throughout the calendar year. And they really put together quite a forceful lobbying effort to get President George Bush to make May Jewish American Heritage Month, and that happened in 2006. And it is celebrated every year in May, and there's been a presidential proclamation every year, and beginning in 2010 and 2011 and 2012, President Obama did have receptions for Jewish American Heritage Month at the White House. This year, because of the sequester, there was not a reception, but events are happening around the country in celebration of Jewish American Heritage Month.
And what kinds of events?
Well, there are everything from speakers at public libraries to special art exhibitions to in San Jose, for instance, in the last few years, there has been the mayor holds a ceremony and creates a proclamation for the day. There are, as I said, lectures and film screenings, and there are many, many different events listed on our website, which is www.jahm.us.
And we'll post that when we post this discussion.
Great.
Okay. And then can you talk about the Jewish American population? Do you have numbers and where you're...
Well, we're a small, a very small percentage of the... There's only like 2% of the American population, but it's an incredible story when you think about from the days that this country was founded that Jewish Americans, like so many other groups in this country who were immigrants and came here and began life here because they were escaping, persecution of many different types. From the beginning, Jewish Americans have had an impact in this country, and it has been, it's something that we as Americans, not just Jewish Americans, but all Americans should celebrate as we celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month and we celebrate African American Heritage Month. I mean, I think that we want to think about this all the time, but particularly in May, we just want to take a step back and realize how many contributions in the arts and music and science and literature and medicine, have been made by Jewish Americans. And this year, for the first time since I've been involved, we designated a theme, Jewish Americans in entertainment. And whether you're talking about comedians or playwrights or musicians or actors, you know, there are so many who have made a significant impact to our society as a whole because of their, you know, their talents and their abilities.
Interesting that you mentioned entertainment, because it was a time where folks who had perhaps a more Jewish surname would change their name.
That's true. There was a period when Jews, and not just Jews, but other ethnic groups and minorities felt that if they really wanted to assimilate, they needed to, you know, identify more with the culture that they were living in and less with their European past or these very ethnic names. And, you know, there was, of course, this during the McCarthy period, you know, this blacklisting of a lot of Jews who were perceived as, you know, who were said to be communists. And, you know, so there was a lot of sort of kind of kept it to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And there are still lots of Jewish people who don't wear this on their sleeve, but and we're not trying to self-promote. We're just trying to help the American public appreciate so many contributions that have been made. And I mentioned entertainment, but there are so many stories that we have on our website which are just sort of make you chuckle. For instance, the shopping cart that we use every day in the supermarket, or the carts that you use to pull your luggage, or the luggage with wheels, none of that would have been possible were it not for this invention by this Oklahoma City Jewish man named Sylvan Goldman, who actually was, you know, had a dry goods store and saw that people were having trouble gathering their groceries, and he invented the shopping cart. You know, so it's the kind of thing that you don't think about, but when you realize how much of an impact that has had on our society, it was, you know, it's just one of, and, you know, his parents were immigrants, you know, it was just one of these, you know, stories of somebody who came from, you know, really very modest roots and developed something that became a staple of American life. So, you know,
it's a new standard. And you highlight those stories on your website.
Yes. On our website, we have a section called Tell Me a Story, which is, and people can, it's interactive. It's intended for people to look at the website, and if they have a great story, it can be submitted. And, you know, we edit and place it on the website. We have something that went up last year, the year before, I believe it was, called 50 States, 50 Stories. And we're not quite to every state, but we have at least one story for every state in the union about, you know, an inventor or an entertainer or a writer or a politician or, you know, someone who hails from each of the 50 states ultimately. And these stories are, you know, some of them are famous people you'd know about, and some of them are not so famous, like our friend Sylvan Goldman. So interesting reading material there, and lots of good resources.
Now, Abby, would you say there's a distinction between Jewish Americans and if and how they practice versus other Jewish folks throughout the world, culturally versus religiously?
Well, I think that's a big question. And of course, in the United States, there are several movements within Judaism. There's Orthodox Judaism, there's conservative, reform, reconstructionist, you know, there's everything ranging from very liberal to very conservative. Practice is not what this is about. This is about
Jewish.
Abby, yes.
I'm going to call you right back because the connection is bad, so apologize for that. Sam here says that helps fix things sometimes, and it's a landline that she's speaking on, and so am I, so...
Hello.
Hi, much better. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So I was saying, this isn't so much about practice as it is about how Jews in America from the time they came here back in the 17th century have interfaced with the larger culture, and how they have truly assimilated or made significant impact.
And because some folks will identify with their Judaism because that's what their culture is, and then some mm-hmm. folks actually practice and go to temple mm-hmm. and honor the holidays and that sort of thing. And I didn't know if that is the same in the rest of the world or if that's uniquely American.
Well, I think that there's, I think that, you know, I can't, I'm not really an expert on Jewish life abroad. You know, I know that I think every country this has been the case, though, because this is a diaspora. These are, you know, every Jews, like other minorities, are, they live their lives, they practice their religion, and then they live in the greater society as well. So I think it's, you know, for every individual, it's a choice of whether they observe the holidays, whether they consider themselves religious, and then they live as Jews within whatever society they are, you know, where they are, whether they're in France or Spain or England. You know, it's a duality, mm-hmm. I think,
well,
everywhere.
The reason I asked the question is that I was in Madrid for four mm-hmm. weeks, and I am a practicing Roman Catholic, and you're uh-huh. in Madrid, Spain, is a Catholic country, and so it happened to be Ash Wednesday, and there's a church on every corner, and I'm like looking where to get ashes, and I don't see anybody with ashes, and I go to class that day, and I said, gosh, you know, what's up with, and they're like, oh, that's, our grandmothers do that. We don't do that.
I see.
Like, yes, they're Catholic, but I don't even know mm-hmm. if they get their sacraments anymore. It's just, it's something that they say, it's not something that they do. So I didn't know if that was...
what you're saying. I think that, you know, again, I think that I'm speaking for myself and lots of my friends who travel the world, and whenever we go anywhere, we seek out, you know, the Jewish community in that country, mm-hmm. and, you know, there's always, you know, a welcoming presence in the synagogues, you know, abroad, but, you know, everybody practices differently, and I guess I would say maybe in Israel, we consider ourselves religious if we go to synagogue every week, and in Israel that's not so much the case. They're living their Judaism every day. Mm-hmm. So you know, I think it's just different wherever you are. But here in America, I think that, you know, there would be those who would say that there's a particular ethic that comes with being an immigrant, and this, you know, strong work ethic and the emphasis on education, you know, when you've come here, so many immigrants with so little, and, you know, you come to a land where there was all of this opportunity, and it's wonderful to celebrate these achievements that Jews have made from the very beginning, and continue to be, you know, to see America as their home and their country, and they are proud to be Americans, but, you know, also have this background that they bring to bear on what they do. You know, you think of someone like Steven Spielberg, who one of his very early movies was a cartoon called An American Tale, and it's about a little mouse named Fievel who comes to America, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's basically the Jewish immigrant experience, but it translates to any immigrant mm-hmm. experience. You know, that's something that I encourage my kids who now have their own children. They say, it's May, rent American Tale and watch it with your kids. You know, it's a great way to think about being a Jewish American. So,
speaking of Israel, can you speak about the Birthright trips?
That's really not something that I don't have any information about that, because it's just not part of our, you know, it has nothing to do with our mission.
Okay.
So. I'm not the expert on that. I'm sorry.
Because that's something that I'm always fascinated by. And then,
I don't know
if you've been hearing, you know, the IRS is under attack with what they've been doing with the Tea Party and the Patriot
uh-huh,
organizations.
Uh-huh.
But there's also a sub-story to that, and it's Israel-related groups are also having experienced that as well. In fact, there's a lawsuit going on in regards to...
I wasn't aware of that. I did not... you know, I did hear that news yesterday and today about the Tea Party groups, but I wasn't aware of the ones that are affected
going through it. Okay.
Israel.
Well, Abby, thank you for your time with us this morning. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and thank you so much for giving me a chance to talk about this Jewish American Heritage Month. And again, our website is www.jahm.us.
Excellent, Abby. Thank you. Have a great day, and appreciate your time. And you know, these folks, it's so sweet because they come to the program and share their knowledge and their expertise, and I really do appreciate it. The story that I am referring to that she didn't know about is one of the groups. It's called Z Street, Z as in zebra, and it filed a lawsuit against the IRS in 2010 saying that one of the IRS attorneys, were told its application for tax exemption was delayed and sent to a special unit to determine whether the organization's activities contradict the administration's public policies. So the suit was filed in federal court in Pennsylvania, and it has been transferred to Washington, D.C. A judge is set to hear the case for July 2nd. So Z Street had applied for the 501c3 status, applied to most charities, allowing for tax deduction donations. The Tea Party groups and the Patriot groups that are in the news also had applied for 501c4, which allows the groups to avoid federal taxes but doesn't allow them to have the donations be tax deductible. That's the distinguishment between the two. So we have time to cover some more stories, which is always exciting. Yesterday we shared with you about Angelina Jolie going through a preventative double mastectomy operation starting in February of this year. And we are going to have our medical correspondent, Dr. Michael Applebaum, speak with us about that. Our schedules didn't coincide, so he wasn't able to speak to it yet. But it's obviously in the news big time. She wrote an op-ed piece yesterday in the New York Times, and then everyone was talking about it. But today is the reply from her significant other, Brad Pitt. He said, "Having witnessed this decision firsthand, I find Angie's choice, as well as many others like her, absolutely heroic. I thank our medical team for their care and focus. All I want is for her to have a long and healthy life with myself and our children. This is a happy day for our family." So her mother died of ovarian cancer at 56 years of age in 2007. And what she was tested positive for, they said her chances of getting breast cancer were 87%. Now it's less than 5%. And that she's also in consideration of having her ovaries removed because of the higher risk of ovarian cancer. And so I downloaded the op-ed piece yesterday to share on the program yesterday morning, and I sent it to my mother and my sister because, as I shared yesterday, my mother had her right breast removed. It'll be 6 years next month, and no one's tested if she's carrying it, because if she is, then my sister and I need to be tested because that might suggest that we are carrying it. So it's something, and the tests are not inexpensive. That's the thing. So you don't just want to run and go and do it unless there's a medical necessity. But having it in the family would suggest to me that it's a medical necessity. So Men's Health Magazine rated the laziest cities and the most active cities in the United States, and the South came in amongst the laziest. Jackson, the capital of Mississippi, is the capital of sloth. It's the least active city in the United States. It was last on the list of 100 cities based on the activity level of its residents, along with, these are all southern, Charlton, West Virginia, Nashville, Tennessee, Columbia, South Carolina, Birmingham, Alabama, and Lexington, Kentucky. The executive editor of the magazine said the South certainly has a cultural reputation for taking it easy and being laid back, and now it's been proven. So what was the most active city? I would, if I was a wagering person, which I'm not, I would say it's got to be somewhere in California. I mean, that's our beaches, our mountains, our lakes, all these opportunities that we have to recreate, and nope, it's Portland, Oregon. Portland was designated the most active city, followed by Boise, Idaho, Salt Lake City, Utah, Minneapolis, and St. Paul, Minnesota. So Southern California, not even one California city was in the top five. And no cities in the Northeast were included among the top 10 most active or least active cities in the United States. So that's all the time we have this morning. Thank you so much for joining us. If you are able to listen live, you can do so at latalkradio.com and stream. We are in iTunes now. You can also download the program on demand, and there are free apps to do so. So we appreciate your ears. We look forward to our conversation tomorrow. Thank you so much for joining us. Maria Sanchez.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.